Time for my podcast audience to learn all about my kinks by accident.
That's all right. I'm putting myself on blast as, you know, the girl who's into priests.
Books. Books. Books.
Welcome to Didn't Read It, the podcast that is very nearly in intelligible English. I am your host, Grace Todd, and with me today is Tony DiNardo. Tony, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi. I'm Tony DiNardo. I am an old friend of Grace's. I'm also a doctoral student, actually doctoral candidate now in English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I work with medieval literature and fantasy literature.
Welcome, Tony. So excited to have you here. Yeah, we have known each other since we were just a couple of teenage shitheads. And now look at us. Look at how far we've come.
35-year-old
shitheads. 35-year-old shitheads on the internet. The best kind. So, Tony, before we kick off, what have you been enjoying in the world of fiction lately?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I used to love reading, and now I barely ever do it because it turns out that getting a PhD in English will just destroy your love of reading. I think the last book I enjoyed was Nona the Ninth, but I have been watching a lot of, like, Netflix lately, and just the schlockiest, like, crappiest shows I can find. All of Mike Flanagan stuff I've just, like, been consuming like mad. Just give me jump scares and, like, hot bisexuals.
I mean, it's really hard to go wrong with jump scares and hot bisexuals. And yeah, when I finished grad school, it took me 6 full months before I could read a book for pleasure again. And in that intervening period, all I could do was watch English people murder each other on the television.
I do enjoy that. I'm a big fan of English people murdering anyone who is English and not just like the rest of the world.
Right. It's fine. It's high time they put these skills to good use, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think I'm really just in it for the hot bisexuals now. Like, I've been watching. I feel like Mike Flanagan is on a quest to make Katie Siegel, like, hotter. And, or not Katie Siegel. No, it might be Katie Siegel. Who's his wife?
I don't know.
Well, you know, she gets hotter and gayer in every incarnation of one of his shows. I love it.
We can make her hotter. We can make her gayer. We can make her gayer and hotter. Until there's eventually some kind of, like, this joke got away from me. What was the... I was looking for, like, what's the thing when, like, the tech...
The singularity.
Yes, the singularity. The hot gay singularity. So, Tony, aside from hot bisexuals, what have you brought us today?
So, today we're going to be talking about Fragment 1 of the Canterbury Tales. The Canterbury Tales was a late 14th century, largely poetic work. I know you're not huge on poetry.
My reputation precedes me.
Yep. I was listening to some old episodes, and you're like, oh yeah, I don't read poetry. Great. That's everything I work with.
Yeah, they were really resistant to prose there for a couple of centuries.
Yeah, well, the Canterbury Tales does actually have a couple prose pieces. One of them is like the worst, most boring tale. But yeah, so the Canterbury Tales was written in the late 14th century by Geoffrey Chaucer, who, along with Shakespeare, is sort of remembered as like one of the greatest luminaries of English literature. I think Chaucer, Shakespeare, and Milton is that like classic trilogy of like the greats.
The triumvirate, yeah.
And when I say Fragment 1, this is because the Canterbury Tales survives in 92 extant manuscripts. The most important ones are what are known as the Ellesmere Manuscript and the Hengert Manuscript. But each of these manuscripts has the tales in a different order.
Oh.
And so they've come to be discussed primarily in terms of fragments, which are collections of tales that are always in the same order together, even if they're in different orders as a fragment, and they're connected to each other by internal markers. The ones we're going to talk about today, the general prologue, ends with the knight being asked to tell a tale. The knight's tale ends with the miller saying that he's going to respond to the knight's tale. In fragment 5, the Franklin, like, specifically says that he's responding to the squire's tale. So the fragments are, like, internally tied together.
Okay.
But they, like, get mixed up in different manuscripts.
So you've got little breadcrumbs that make it clear in some cases which is supposed to follow the other, but not in all of them.
Exactly.
I think a lot of people don't realize, and I certainly didn't realize until I started doing research for this podcast, the extent to which the versions of especially like medieval Elizabethan, you know, anything kind of prior to the 1700s, the extent to which everything we have is like a grab bag of guesswork. Because by the time you get it, it's just like a Penguin paperback.
Yeah. And part of this is because, I mean, Chaucer at least is pre-printing. When I say manuscripts, like, I mean manuscripts. The 92 extant copies of the Canterbury Tales are written by hand. None of them actually is in Chaucer's hand. We don't have a holograph. We don't have any copy that he actually wrote himself. Though Ellesmere and Hengart both were probably done by someone who did have access to Chaucer's holograph, and Hengart at least was probably at least partly supervised by Chaucer in the last year of his life.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, so it's mostly a poem. I know you don't like poems, but you know, I do. It also has a framing device, though, and I know you do love a framing device.
I do love a framing device.
So I want to start out by talking about that framing device, which it's narrated by a character that is a fictionalized version of Chaucer. Chaucer actually, like, appears within the story.
Ooh, love a self-insert.
Oh, yeah. Though his, like, it's so funny, his self-insert is, like, kind of bumbling and foolish and, like, very much ragging on himself. He also gives himself the two most boring stories.
He's like, I can't possibly attribute these to my beloved fictional creations. I'll just give them to myself.
No. He gets the worst bits. Well, okay. There are a few that are arguably as bad. So I wanted to start out, if I could, by reading about 20 lines of the general prologue, which is the first part of the Canterbury Tales, partly because it kind of sets up the story, and partly because it's just fun to hear Middle English read aloud. Because if you look at Middle English on the page, it looks at times a lot like modern English, but we had this thing called the Great Vowel Shift. Where the way certain vowels are pronounced in English changes. And so when you hear Middle English read aloud, words that you would think you know how to pronounce are pronounced completely differently.
Yes, please give us a reading.
Okay. Want. So in Middle English, that WH, like at the beginning of when and why, is hwa, hwa.
What?
Exactly. Will Wheaton. And so Middle English scholars pride themselves on getting that, like, hw. So, Juan that April, with his surest suit, the drought of March hath pierced to the root, and bothered every vein in switch liqueur, of which virtue engendered is the floor. Juan Zephyrus ache with his sweet a breath, in spirit hath in every holt and heath the tender croppers, and the younger son hath in the ram his half course irun, and smaller fowls makin melody that sleppen all the nicht with open e. So pricketh him nature in here courages, than longen folk to gone on pilgrimages, and palmers for to sake in stronger strandes, to fair na hallways coth in sundry landes, and specially from every shearer's end of England, to Canterbury they wend, the holy blissful martyr for to sick, that him hath hopen when that they were sick. Befell that in that season on a day, in Southwark at the tabard as he lay, ready to wend in on me pilgrimage to Canterbury with full devout courage, at nicht was come into that hostelry, well 29 in a company, of sundry folk by aventure fall, in fellowship and pilgrimages were they all, that toward Canterbury wouldn't read. So in like a really rough English, modern English translation, what we have here basically is, you know, when April with its sweet showers, the whole like April showers bring May flowers thing goes all the way back to the Middle Ages. When April with its sweet showers bathes all the plants and causes flowers to grow, and the west wind is bringing the meadows to life, and the sun is in Aries, and the birds are singing, people's spirits are aroused to go on pilgrimages to faraway places and to bring back relics. And here in England, especially, everyone goes to Canterbury to the shrine of Thomas à Becket. The holy blissful martyr is Thomas à Becket, you know, the will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest.
Yeah.
And it happened that one day I, Chaucer, was on pilgrimage to Canterbury, and I stopped at the Tabard Inn in Southwark, which is a real inn that existed in the Middle Ages. It was a major starting point for pilgrimages to Canterbury. It's about 2 days on foot or on like a slow walking horse from Southwark in London to Canterbury. Okay. And I came upon a group of 29 pilgrims who were traveling together to Canterbury. Also, this is really important. He says 29. There are 30 pilgrims. My like colleagues and I sent them a text. I'm like, am I on drugs or does Chaucer miscount? And like all my friends are like, hold on, let me check. They're all like rereading it themselves. They're like reading lists that people have published. And they're like, no, there are 30 pilgrims.
Like, plot hole.
Yeah. So there's 30 pilgrims plus Chaucer. And then they're also joined eventually by Harry Bailey, who is the innkeeper. And then later on the road, they'll be joined by a canon, who's a sort of like religious brother who also works as an alchemist, and his servant, the canon's yeoman. So by the end of the tale, there's 34 people.
That's a lot more people than I thought there were for some reason. In my head, there's like 7 of them.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's probably because there are like 7 that are like really, really well known.
So wait, we have an actual tale for all 30 of these people?
No.
Okay.
So we have these 30 people. Chaucer like actually lists them all. That's most of what the general prologue is a description of those people. And I kind of want to like save the descriptions for when we talk about the characters in each fragment, because they're often very lengthy and often kind of funny. But just in short, there's this group of people. They represent kind of all of the three estates of like medieval life. There's members of the gentry, there's members of religious orders, and then there's like everyday working people. There's a knight and his son, who is his squire, and a yeoman who is their sort of freeman servant.
Okay.
There's a prioress and a nun who serves as her secretary, and 3 priests who are traveling with them. There's a monk, a friar, a merchant, and a clerk, which is a sort of Middle English-like bureaucratic functionary. Chaucer himself was actually a clerk.
Desk jockey.
A lawyer, or man of law, as he's called, and a franklin, which is basically a, like, freeman who serves as like a liaison between the peasantry and the gentry. 5 members of trade guilds. So we have a haberdasher, a carpenter, a weaver, a dyer, and a tapestry maker, and a cook who is traveling with them. A shipman or sailor, a physician, the ever infamous and beloved wife of Bath. Wife of Bath literally just means she is a woman from Bath. We have a country parson, so like a local country priest, a plowman, a miller, a manciple, which is someone who is in charge of purchasing like food and provisions for like a school or an inn of court or something like that. A reeve, which is a sort of medieval county accountant, basically.
Okay.
A summoner, which is someone who's responsible for sending like subpoenas for the ecclesiastical courts, the church courts. And then a pardoner, who is someone who sells indulgences.
I feel like you just took me through like a medieval Richard Scarry book.
Yeah, like... it really is though. Like this would be the like a walk through town. The pardoner sells indulgences and holy relics.
It's like a little cat in like a jerkin. Like
yeah. Oh god. Yeah. The pardoner is one of my favorite characters. I hope we eventually get to, I think it's fragment 10 that he's in. But basically what ends up happening, Chaucer strikes up a conversation with this group of pilgrims who are traveling to Canterbury together, visit safety in numbers, and he decides that he's going to travel with them. And so for some reason does Harry Bailey. Like, he's just like, whatever, my wife can run the inn, and I'm going to come with to Canterbury. By the way, in addition to the Tabard Inn in Southwark being a real inn, Harry Bailey was the real owner of the Tabard Inn in the time that Chaucer was writing. So this is also a real person, probably heavily characterized, but like someone who may have been known to Chaucer's readers.
Like a kind of boring mid-level local celebrity sort of arrangement.
Exactly, yeah. Like, you know, there's, you know, Chaucer and all these people, and there's Harry the publican, and everyone's like, oh, Harry, you know, and like the theme from Cheers is playing in the background.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you know old Harry, always bailing on his wife to go on pilgrimage on short notice. Like,
that's actually why Harry Bailey. It's because he's always bailing on his wife. Yeah. So... Harry decides he's going to come along too, and he suggests, because it's, you know, 2 days out and 2 days back, he's like, we're going to pass the time by having a storytelling competition. Everyone's going to tell 4 stories, 2 on the way to Canterbury, 2 on the way back to Canterbury. I'm going to decide what the best story is, and the winner will get like a fancy 10-course meal at everyone else's expense. So,
huh.
We do not obviously have 136, if my math is right, tales. We don't even have one tale for every pilgrim. There are 5 or 6 pilgrims, at least, who never tell a story. And no pilgrim tells more than one story. Chaucer died with the book incomplete. Whether because, you know, he just didn't have time to finish it before he died, or because he just kind of gave up on finishing it. We don't know, but it is incomplete, as all great medieval works are.
So we don't know who won?
No, we don't know who won, though we do... Well, we have indications that it probably would have been the parson.
Okay.
Because his tale is sort of the most spiritually beneficial, and it's told like right as they're arriving at Canterbury. Though also the host also expresses a love for Chaucer's Tale of Milleby, which is widely regarded as the most boring tale.
I'm having a very hard time not making some kind of a George R.R. Martin joke about him, about Chaucer dying with the giant epic book unfinished and us never finding out who won.
You know, the thing is, I'm like, is Martin doing this on purpose? A colleague of mine gave a paper a couple years back about Plutarch, the Italian poet Plutarch, whose work Chaucer was very familiar with and who Chaucer met. Plutarch's works not only are like all incomplete, they're all like very intentionally incomplete, because like that's what great poets do. Virgil died without finishing his poem, and so great poets die without finishing their poems. And I wonder, like, yeah, it, you know, especially because I know he's so like in love with Robert Jordan, is George R. R. Martin like, I too will die with my book series unfinished and my fans unfulfilled and alienated?
That's the best theory I've heard so far. This is fantastic. George R. R. Martin, medieval poet. He's like, I can't finish my epic.
Yeah, it would ruin my historical cred.
I mean, that is a path to infamy.
So the first story is the knight. And this is because the knight is like the person in this party who has kind of the highest social rank. He is a member of the gentry. He is like a well-decorated soldier. There's this like long list of his achievements that I think someone once pointed out, if he started soldiering at like 13 and fought every day of his life until he was like 75, he could maybe conceivably have fought in all of these battles, because like there is like a 50 something year span between like the earliest of the battles that's listed and the latest. And he's an interesting character in that, like, on the one hand, Chaucer describes him as a very perfect genteel knicht, a very perfect and genteel knight. He's, you know, well-spoken, he rides well, he can do the, like, sort of aristocratic things that a knight would be expected to do. But also, when he's described, Chaucer says, "A fustian he weared a guipon, all besmothered with his habergeon." So he's wearing simple clothes of corduroy, like a simple overcoat of corduroy, and under it is this kind of rusty red smatter that maybe it's rust off his armor, maybe it's blood, it's left very ambiguous, but like the important thing is that like under his gentility, this guy is a soldier. Probably a mercenary, but you know, that's a little more really getting into ambiguity.
And maybe presenting himself as like a little bougier than he actually is at the end of the day.
And it kind of ties into some of the underlying themes of his tale. So he tells a tale about what Shakespeare would later call two noble kinsmen. The play Two Noble Kinsmen is based off the Knight's Tale. And it's a story about these two cousins, Palamon and Arcite, who are captured by Duke Theseus of Athens. Theseus is the one who slew the Minotaur.
Right, yes, important.
Theseus conquers Thebes, basically because the king is an evil dick. And during the battle, Palamon and Arcite, who are fighting on the Theban side, are knocked out and captured. And Theseus sticks them in a tower to live under house arrest forever.
Oh no.
One day, Palamon wakes up in the tower and he looks out the window and he sees Theseus's sister-in-law, Amelia, picking flowers out in the garden, and he immediately falls in love with her.
Rookie mistake.
He's like, "Oh, what is this thing in front of me? Is it a woman? Is it a goddess? My heart. Oh, woe is me." And while he's moaning and sighing, Arcite wakes up and also instantly falls in love with Amelia. They have this little tiff where Palamon's like, "You dick, I was in love with her first." And Arcite comes back with this response where he's basically like, "Well, you said you didn't even know if she was a woman or a goddess. I saw her and I immediately loved her as a man loves a woman. So actually, I loved her first."
I'm getting real high school vibes from this whole fight.
I mean, these guys are probably like 16.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Eventually, both Palamon and Arcite get out of the tower. In Palamon's case, he escapes. And in Arcite's case, a friend of both Arcite and Theseus convinces Theseus to let him out and to banish him rather than leaving him imprisoned for life. So Arcite is on the run. Palamon is banished. What do? Being smart young boys, they both stick around in Thebes and both try to go after Amelia.
Yeah, sounds about right.
it's brilliant. There's no flaws in this plan. They run into each other and they get in a fight in a bush over Amelia. And Theseus basically like rides over them. It's like, what the f-? What, my horse? Oh, there's these guys fighting in a bush. Didn't I imprison you and kick you out? This just isn't done. Like, I'm going to have you both executed.
Harsh but fair.
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing. Theseus is always harsh but fair. He's the like great example of order and justice in the poem. His wife Hippolyta, the queen of the Amazons, instead is like, what if you don't kill them? What if you call a grand tournament? They'll each find 100 warriors to ride with them, and they'll fight a big off battle, and whoever wins gets to marry Amelia. And if you're wondering, was Amelia asked about this? No. Of course not. No, no.
Literally never.
It doesn't work that way.
That is not how medieval affection works in a general sense, by my understanding.
You know, like, weirdly enough, outside of the nobility, like, consent and marriages as affairs of like love and affection are a lot more common in the Middle Ages than people think of. It's really only like the gentry who are doing this sort of trading and selling of women. The worst part, though, about Fragment 1 is that this is probably the most consensual relationship.
Oh, no.
In Fragment 1. It's just downhill from here.
Cool.
So the night before the tournament, there's this scene where all three, Arsate, Palamon, and Amelia, go to the temples and they pray about what's going to happen the next day. Arsate goes to the Temple of Mars. He prays for victory in battle. Palamon goes to the Temple of Venus, and he prays for Amelia's hand. He prays to marry Amelia. And Amelia goes to the Temple of Diana. First, she prays to not get married at all.
Oh!
And then she prays that if that can't be the case, which obviously it can't, to at least be married to whichever man loves her more.
Aw, that's nice.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And it's going to lead to such a happy ending. So because they're all so pious and so devout, the gods hear them and they're like, we've got to try and make things work out so that everybody gets what they prayed for in the best way they can. So the battle happens the next day. Palamon and Arsate and their soldiers take the field. Arsate and his knights fight ferociously. They win the battle. And his prayer to Mars is fulfilled. He prayed for victory in battle and he gets it. And then his horse immediately collapses on him and like crushes his lungs and he dies.
You got what you asked for.
Yeah, like he has like enough time to give this little speech to his cousin where he's like, I'm so sorry that we fought like this. I love you and I want you to marry Amelia. So Palamon gets his prayer, right? He prayed to Venus to get to marry Amelia and he gets that even though Arsate won the battle. And Amelia, of course, gets the shit version of her prayer. She has to get married. She was never getting that. But she gets married to the guy who prayed for her instead of praying to win.
Okay, yeah, all right. That's about as good as anyone can ask for, from her perspective.
Yeah, and Theseus thinks so too, because he gives this big speech about how everything is just how God wants it to be, and that's the end of the tale. He's like, this worked out perfectly. The first mover, as he like refers to God, the first mover in his wisdom made everything happen exactly how it should. And this is the thing with Theseus, is he's always this wise voice for order and things being in their place and things being very like sort of organized and lawful. And it just kind of just like the knight and his manners covering up the like blood on his shirt. Theseus is kind of the mannerly voice that covers up the fact that this tale's a fucking nightmare. Arsate, there's like several lines of the description of just his chest caved in.
Ugh.
And modern readers are not the only people to sort of realize that under this flowery chivalric romance is something a lot seedier, because the next tale completely lampoons it.
Oh.
So the knight finishes telling his story, and Harry Bailey calls on the monk to tell a tale, which makes sense because the monk is kind of the next person in the social order. But he gets interrupted by the miller, who is completely drunk, and he's like, I've got a tale to quite the Knight's Tale, to pay back and respond to the Knight's Tale. And he's like, I'm going to tell a tale. It's going to be a good tale. It's going to be morally advantageous. But just to warn you, I am drunk. So if it's not actually a good tale and morally advantageous, you really can't hold that against me. That's not my fault.
It's nice to know that bar dynamics do not change at all for the next several hundred years.
No, it's exactly like, it's this guy going, hold on. I've got a story for you.
You think that's a story? Check this out.
So the miller tells a story about a carpenter who has a beautiful wife named Allison, but he's also an idiot. And so the carpenter rents a room in his house to a young Oxford student named Nicholas. And you also, with this and the next tale, you'll see like students being horny and also just terrible tricksters. It's just a common running theme in Chaucer, which makes sense.
College students also have not changed much in the intervening centuries.
No, not even a little. If anything, they've gotten worse. So Nicholas wants to have sex with Allison, and in just this sort of way of the level of consent just declining as the stories go on, one day when John, the carpenter, is away, Nicholas grabs her by the quaint.
Oh.
Which is a Middle English word carrying both the like modern connotation of the word quaint, but also being the etymological root of the modern word. And it gets used constantly as a double entendre. Allison kind of protests in this way that is implied to be sort of coy, but is, as is often the case, really kind of ambiguous. But finally she's like, okay, well, let's have sex. And they start having an affair. And there's a couple lines of them just sneaking time when they can. But Nicholas is like, I want to get to spend a whole night with you. And so he hatches a plan. He is up in his tower in the miller's house, and he screams out in terror. Not the miller, the carpenter's house. And he screams out in terror. And the carpenter comes running, and he's like, what's wrong? And he's like, I was reading the stars. I was doing my astrology and reading the stars. And I saw signs that there's going to be another flood, even worse than Noah's flood. And so what we need to do, I'm telling you and I'm telling your wife and I'm not telling anyone else, we're the only ones who are going to be prepared. I need you to make big bathtubs and hang them from the ceiling. We'll climb into them. And once the water reaches its highest level, we'll cut the ropes and we'll float away. And John, because he's a f***ing idiot, is like, yeah, obviously that makes sense. I'll get right to that. He makes the tubs. They tie them to the ceiling. Everyone climbs in. They do the whole, what is it, the Waltons or whatever. They're like, good night, John. Good night, Nicholas. Good night, John boy. And as soon as John falls asleep, Allison and Nicholas leave their tubs and they run off to like bunnies all night.
Yeah, sounds right. You know, some people are just kind of asking to be conned is the thing. You can't help it. You're just like, well, this had to happen. This had to go this way.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, Chaucer loves his cons. Honestly, most of these tales in Fragment 1 are just cons. So they go off and they're having sex. And this guy comes around. There's this local clerk named Absalon who sees Allison at church every day and is in love with her. Allison, for her part, wants nothing to do with Absalon. She's like, this guy is pretentious and annoying. But he comes around while Allison and Nicholas are having sex. And he's like, Allison, come to the window and give me a kiss. And she's like, yeah, okay, all right, yeah, I'll give you a kiss. I'll give you a kiss out the window, but only if you close your eyes.
Oh, no.
And he closes his eyes. She sticks her bare ass out the window, and he kisses her right on the brown eye. Literally, in the poem, he kisses her on the nether eye, the back eye.
Vowel pronunciations may come and go, but an ass-kissing joke is forever.
Oh, it's probably one of the most infamous scenes in this poem. He realizes what's up, because he's like, I don't remember her having a beard.
Oh, yep.
So he's like, I'm going to get revenge. And he goes to the blacksmith and he's like, give me a red hot poker. And the blacksmith's like, yeah, sure. Because you just give random people red hot pokers when they ask.
I mean, I pick up a red hot poker every Tuesday morning and just kind of carry it around.
Yeah, just in case you need to stick it in anyone. He goes back and he calls up to the window and he's like, Allison, give me one more kiss. And Allison is like, okay, this would be even funnier. Nicholas sticks his ass out the window.
Oh, dear.
And Absalom sticks the red hot poker into it.
Ow!
Nicholas screams out in pain. And he's like, water! Water! John, remember John? John's still in a tub tied to the ceiling. Uh-huh. John hears, water! Water! And he's like, shit, the flood is here. He wakes up, he cuts the rope, and he goes crashing to the floor. And then the whole town comes to point and laugh at him. Somehow John just gets completely the short end of the stick. The entire clown, he's there with a broken arm, and the whole town is just there laughing at him.
This whole thing is a f***ing Monty Python sketch.
Yes, so Monty Python, fun fact, the guys from Monty Python, they were all like Oxbridge boys. They all went to Oxford and Cambridge. They all did classics and medieval literature. And like, okay. Chaucer was a huge influence on Monty Python, both because they appreciated his humor and because they hated their tutors who made them read all this Middle English literature. And that's why, like, Monty Python and the Holy Grail was them just being like, what if we did all the funny bits of the Middle Ages?
Yeah, honestly, that makes perfect sense. Beat for beat, everything you just said oh my God. All right. So he's fallen off the ceiling. He's being laughed at by the whole town.
So the Reeve has been listening to this tale, and the Reeve, before he was a Reeve, was a carpenter. And he's a little upset with Robin the Miller for telling this story. It's actually left kind of ambiguous whether there's already this existing antagonism between the two, but he's certainly upset about this story. He's upset that the Miller has told a story about a wily student having sex with an idiot carpenter's wife, and he's like, I'm going to quote the Miller's tale. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to tell a story about two wily students having sex with a stupid and dishonest miller's wife and daughter. So there's a bit of a pattern here as it just gets like worse and worse. The Reeve tells a story about these two Cambridge students, John and Alan, who don't trust the local miller, Simkin. They're like, he is always swindling us whenever we bring grain to him to grind. He's stealing part of it and adulterating it with hay and oat husks and stuff like that. We're going to catch him. And what we're going to do, they go and they're like, oh, can we watch you grind the grain? We don't know anything about milling. We just want to see how it's done. Simkin's like, yeah, you want to try and stop me from stealing your grain. And he's like, I'm going to steal even more of their grain. These kids. He lets their horse loose. And while they're like running around, and again, Monty Python skit, they're running back and forth trying to catch this horse while he's comically like silent movie villain, just shoveling their grain into his own bag.
Into a giant sack marked stolen grain.
Yes. Yeah, cackling. Exactly.
Yep. Good.
So they're like, this guy, we've got to get back at him. And they start by convincing the miller to let them stay at his house that night because they're like, it's too late to get home. We'll pay you. Let us stay here.
We're just babies.
So he sets them up. The two students, Alan and John, are sleeping in one bed. The miller and his wife are in another bed and they have their baby's cradle at the foot of it. And then their 20-year-old daughter, Melanie, is in a third bed. And John and Alan hatch a very seedy plan to, putting it very delicately, get their repayment from the miller for swindling them from the women in the house.
Oh no.
So Alan climbs into Melanie's bed and has sex with her. And this is, again, one of those things. It's left very ambiguous with Alan and Melanie. On the one hand, it is literally just like he leapt upon her and started having sex with her, started to swive with her. On the other hand, in the morning, she's protesting her love for him, and in Boccaccio's Decameron, which Chaucer was familiar with and which he took the Reeve's tale from, it's a lot less ambiguous. Melanie is part of this thing. She is consensually having sex with Alan. In this, it's much more ambiguous. What is not ambiguous is what John does. John, when the miller's wife gets up in the middle of the night to go pee, he tricks her by pushing the baby's cradle in front of his bed so that the miller's wife comes back, she climbs into bed with John, and John starts having sex with her, and she thinks that he's the miller.
She just lacks basic object permanence.
Well, she's also completely drunk. Like, she and the miller both are described as drinking so much wine at dinner, completely toasted.
Okay, fair enough. So she's faced.
Yes, and that's why she had to get up and pee in the middle of the night, because she's had so much wine.
That's the only reason anyone pees in the middle of the night.
Yes,
fun fact.
Yeah. No one else pees in the middle of the night. Alan gets up and he comes back to what he thinks is his and John's bed, because it doesn't have the cradle in front of it. Alan also has no object permanence. He climbs into the bed and he like shakes the miller, thinking that the miller is John. And he's like, hey, John, guess what?
Guess what I just did?
I just had sex with the miller's daughter 3 times. The miller wakes up in a rage. And it leads to this scene where the miller's wife wakes up. She thinks that the miller, because he's in the other bed, is one of the students going crazy. And so she hits him with a club. Then the students beat the shit out of him. And on the way out, Melanie is like, by the way, my mom and I baked a loaf of bread out of your stolen grain, and it's by the back door. So they leave the beaten up miller, they take the bread, they grab their horse, and they off.
It's a little known fact that object permanence wasn't actually invented until the 1700s. Before that, we couldn't keep track of where things were when we left a room and came back.
Well, and so this is one of those things, like, early modern and medieval literature are both full of stuff like the bed trick and the cradle trick and all these different things that are various ways that someone gets tricked into sleeping with someone. It's like, do y'all not know where the shit is in your bedroom? Like...
Do you not notice when your furniture gets rearranged? Apparently, again, object permanence invented in the 1700s. This is the official position of Didn't Read It, the podcast.
So the Reeve finishes up his rapey story.
Uh-huh.
And the cook is basically like, he says, so, you know, the cook was with the guildsmen. He's like, well, I mean, if we're telling dirty stories, I've got one. Like, I've got a really funny story. Harry Bailey pops in and he's like, okay, go ahead. Hopefully it's not as bad as your cooking, LOL.
Sick burn.
The cook's like, well, fine. I'm going to tell a story about a bitch-ass innkeeper since you're so funny.
So much character assassination happening here.
Oh, they're constantly shitting on each other. Like, I don't think anyone in this party likes each other. The cook starts in. He starts telling this story. He's like, there was this apprentice named Perkin, and he liked hookers and blow, basically. Like, he just spent every day shagging girls, drinking beers, and dancing until his boss fired him for being such a playboy and spending all of his money on hookers and blow. Then he moved in with a prostitute, and that's it. That is, it just stops. There is no more story.
That's it. That's the story.
That is the end of the fragment. Chaucer never finished the story. There's a lot of debate over whether Chaucer ever intended to finish that story. About 30 of the manuscripts, someone has stuck in a medieval outlaw tale called The Tale of Gamelin. And some scholars think that Chaucer was intending to rewrite it to be the cook's tale. Generally, like, no one believes anymore that Chaucer himself wrote it. It's considered anonymous, but we don't know how the cook's tale was going to end. That is the end of fragment one, is the cook being like, I've got something even fucking worse, and Chaucer just not being able to think of something worse.
It's just 404 error, file not found. So that's fragment one. That's all.
That's fragment one.
Okay, so to review, we've got lovelorn youths in tower get themselves killed married. via prayer.
Mary kill, but make it religious.
Oh my God. Yeah, marry, kill, but make it religious in a tower.
Next is a horny boys fighting over girl and butt kissing.
Right, butt kissing. Yes, okay. Ceiling bathtubs and butt kissing and red hot poker vengeance. Poker? I hardly know her. And then no object permanence daughter sexing with big bag of stolen grain, followed by, if you guys think that's horny, I'll show you horny. And then it just fades to black.
Exactly. Yeah.
What a triumph of English literature. I mean, it is. And as we're going to discuss, it is a triumph of English literature. But people underestimate how fucking horny all this is.
Yeah. This is a work that is widely regarded as one of the most sublime works of English literature. I mean, this is the earliest, closest thing that England has to a poet laureate. Chaucer, at one point, was given a lifetime allowance of a gallon of wine a day by Edward III. And it's generally believed that it was probably as payment for one of his poetic works. Chaucer was originally buried, I think, in a different part of Canterbury Cathedral, but eventually was dug up and became the first person buried in what's now the Poets' Corner of Canterbury Abbey. This is the closest thing to England's first poet laureate. And so many of his poems are just like horny, goofy nonsense.
Well, I mean, as we all know, in the middle of his career, he took a break to champion a young commoner who was pretending to be a knight so that he could win the heart of a beautiful lady and also dance to early 2000s pop music.
You know, a friend of mine has been chastising me for 3.5 years now about the fact that I have never seen The Knight's Tale.
What?
I mean, oh, no, she's sorry. Like, hang on. Tony, you're a medievalist.
Hang on. What? Was that good? Did I do it right?
You did. It was so good. So good.
Thank you. It is, in my opinion, Chaucer's best on-screen appearance.
So the funny thing is that is this friend of mine, Jillian, this is her opinion, too. She's like, this is the best version of Chaucer in cinema.
We need to do, you have to go watch it. And then the next time we get together to discuss the Canterbury Tales, I expect you to have seen A Knight's Tale.
I'll put it on my homework list. Write prospectus, yes. Do first chapter, watch Knight's Tale.
It'll inspire you. It'll carry you through the rest of the thesis. You just imagine the opening, you know, and I'm not going to spoil it for you. Anyway, so Chaucer, when he wasn't naked and being played by Paul Bettany.
Yes. So, you know, I think I mentioned Chaucer makes fun of students and he makes fun of clerks a fair amount of the time. So he makes fun of students and he makes fun of sort of government bureaucrats. And a lot of this is actually poking fun at himself. Chaucer, one important to note, you know, Chaucer is not a like rags to riches story of the successful boy from the suburbs, or not from the suburbs, but like, you know, the boy from the country who comes to the big city, learns to do poetry, and like makes it big. Chaucer is like the ultimate Nepo baby. His father was a wealthy wine merchant. His grandfather was a vintner. There's various like financial records and whatnot that indicate that his family had a ton of money. Like his aunt at one point kidnapped his father.
What? Sorry. What?
She wanted his father, John, I want to say, to marry her daughter in order to, like, solidify the family money. For that kidnapping, she was fined £15,000, which was quite a large sum for
that's
England
huge.
At the time. It's probably equivalent to about £200,000 now.
Jesus. Also, were you legally allowed to marry your niece? No, wait, aunt. Yeah.
Cousin. It would have been, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Cousin makes more sense. I got confused and thought it was like his sister trying to get him to marry her. Doesn't matter. Cousin makes more sense. Still not great, but more logical.
Yeah. So yeah, lots of money. Whether Chaucer studied at university is actually unclear. There's a good chance he did. He was certainly learned. In addition to English, he would have spoken both French and Latin as the like main legal and ecclesiastical languages of England at the time. He also probably spoke Italian. Oh, he spent a fair amount of time in Italy. He knew Plutarch and Boccaccio. He had read Dante. As a teenager, he was sent to serve as a page to Elizabeth de Burgh, the Countess of Ulster. And that was the start of basically a lifetime of civil service. He was well known in the government. He was successful. Miss Marjorie, really?
Is that a kitty?
Yeah, yes. Playing with the spinny ball. Marjorie, who is named for Marjorie Kemp, another wonderful figure from medieval literature.
Oh, man, I have been contemplating covering Marjorie Kemp, even though it's not technically fiction.
I would love to do Marjorie Kemp.
You have to be careful, because you're slowly getting roped into being our official medieval correspondent, and then you're never going to get rid of us.
I'm fine with that. You know, I there's no job security in academia, so, you know, this unpaid thing that I'm doing, you know, at least I can be like, you know, Tony DiNardo, medieval correspondent.
Yeah, exactly. It's great resume fodder. I will write you a letter of recommendation. Be like, she is incredible.
So as a teenager, he was paged to the Countess of Ulster and then just became very well known in government. He was good friends with John of Gaunt, who was the progenitor. John of Gaunt was the father of statistics. He was good friends with John of Gaunt, who was the progenitor of the House of Lancaster. So like the Wars of the Roses, you have the House of Lancaster and the House of York.
Yeah.
John of Gaunt was the grandfather of the House of Lancaster. He served under three kings, under Edward III, Richard II, and Henry IV. And all three of them were probably at least vaguely personally acquainted with him. He received a fair amount of money through his life at the hands of the government. You know, I mentioned his gallon of wine a day that Edward III gave him. Richard II and Henry IV would both later confirm that grant, but they both just turned it into money.
Yeah, fair. He was like, you know, gallons of wine is great, but have you considered cash?
Yeah, well, especially because, like, in this time, it's not like he was drinking a gallon of wine a day.
Right.
This would have been kind of like the stock market, like wine sitting in a royal warehouse somewhere that theoretically Chaucer owned, but realistically he would be writing, like, promissory notes against this wine.
His 365 gallons of wine.
Yeah, it's probably quite literally a ton of wine. I can't remember how much is in a ton, but we can ask Corey.
I was going to say, I know someone I could ask about this.
He was a diplomat for several years in Italy. He was comptroller of the Port of London for a decade, which apparently like was a position that usually have really high turnover. So it was, you know, it was impressive that he did it for a decade. He was commissioner of the peace for his native Kent. And eventually he was for a year or two a member of parliament for Kent. He was a member of the House of Commons.
So was he writing this whole time? Or is this one of those things where like lawyers get burned out at 42 and then write crime novels and become famous?
No, you didn't get to get burned out back then. There was just kind of this expectation. A lot of people who were associated with court in their spare time also produced poetry and romances and things like that. You know, this is something that we see continue into the early modern period. You know, all of the courtiers in the Elizabethan court are all writing books of sonnets and plays and stuff like that. It's also something that was not always as gendered as you would think. If we go, you know, a century and a half earlier, you have Marie de France, who was a woman in the Angevin court, who wrote a series of poems, who may actually have been Henry II's sister, but that's just one theory of who she was. And this was something that he was doing alongside all of his work.
So it was like a hobby. I mean, the way that we would, it wasn't his main source of income. It was something he was doing on the side, even if he got quite famous for it. Is that?
Yes. And part of this is because pre, like, the sort of establishment of what we now think of as like copyright, insofar as you got paid for writing at all, it was this thing where you wrote something and maybe it got to someone who was rich and influential and they became a patron of yours. They commissioned works, or they, you know, like with this gallon of wine a day, which was probably because of something he had written, you know, they gave you some sort of reward for what you wrote. But there was no, you didn't go to a publisher and be like, hey, here's a proposal for a book, and then they write up a contract with payments and royalties and whatnot. There was no real way to be a professional writer in the late 14th century.
In my opinion, this is one of the many problems with late stage capitalism, is that rich people don't keep artist pets anymore. And what more could any of us ask for than to be a rich person's artist pet? I mean, really?
I mean, I absolutely agree. I just want to be the little snarky academic that some king keeps around to write witty little, like, Erasmian treatises on everyone in the court.
Yeah. If we're going to have historic levels of income inequality, the rich need to understand that they have got to go back to, like, buying expensive artisanal goods and keeping artists as domestic staff. This is the only thing between them and the guillotine. I'm just saying.
And give us wine.
Yeah.
They have so much. They have cellars full of it.
Give me a gallon of wine a day and I'll revolutionize the concept of English literature.
Yeah. So no, this Chaucer, I think Chaucer's earliest written, Chaucer was probably written, born sometime in the 1340s. His earliest written works, I think, probably show up in like the late 1360s. So in his like mid-20s. And he's pretty consistently writing from then until the time he dies. Book of the Duchess, The Legend of Good Women, Troilus and Cressida, which was the basis for another Shakespeare play, Troilus and Cressida, Parliament of Fowls, which is just birds. Just birds.
What do you mean, just birds?
It's a dream vision about a bunch of birds of prey arguing over who is most deserving of the love of this, like, girl eagle that is beloved of Aphrodite, I think it is.
Proto-romantic Animal Farm? What?
Yeah, it also, here's the thing though, is it's also the most like, hey, finally, consent of Chaucer's works. Because at the end of it, after all these birds argue over who should get to have the ladybird's like, I don't want any of these dudes. Like, can I just like fly off free? And, you know, whichever goddess it is, honestly, I'd have to look it up. I don't think it's Aphrodite now that I think of it. But whichever goddess it is, it's like, yeah, go fly, girl.
Go on with your bad self. Take a flight.
And like even the Canterbury Tales itself, Chaucer spent probably about 17 years writing. Probably the earliest parts of it were written in like 1383, I want to say, is when he's generally believed to have started writing the Canterbury Tales, and then he was still writing them when he died in 1400.
So I frequently forget that he wrote so much other stuff that we also have, you know, that we have copies of, or at least decently good copies of. So why are the Canterbury Tales the thing of his that everyone was forced to read at least a little bit of in high school at some point?
I think it's a lot of things. One, it's interesting in sort of its linguistic forms. It's a really good early example of decasyllabic verse and rhyming couplets starting to rise to popularity. It's not quite iambic pentameter like Shakespeare, And it's not always exactly 10 syllables, but it's usually somewhere around there, and it's got the rhyming couplets, and it's starting to take on that iambic pattern. Part of it is just, I think, the sheer obvious enjoyability of some of the tales. You know, like Troilus and Cresseide, for instance, has some comedy to it, and it has some pathos to it. But like Troilus and Cresseide, I think, requires a little more help to read than the Canterbury Tales. Canterbury Tales, I think, are really accessible to people.
The Monty Python-ness of it all.
Yeah. You know, they are often quite funny. You know, I think some of the tales that are remembered the most extensively, the Miller's Tale, the Wife of Bath's prologue, you know, they're often quite funny. They deal with themes that we often still find quite relatable, even if sometimes that relatability is rooted in readings that can at times be sort of old-fashioned and uncritical. The Knight's Tale has endured as this wonderful, glowing example of the chivalric romance and of the courtly love tradition. And it wasn't really until like the 1950s that you started to have scholars be like, you know, maybe we could talk about what a mess this story actually is. You know, the Wife of Bath's prologue sometimes gets remembered as this proto-feminist work in a way that's debatable. But I think there's so much to it, and there's something for everyone in the Canterbury Tales.
That makes a lot of sense. There's a lot there. If I remember correctly from like the pieces and bits of it that I touched on way back in undergrad as a wee babby, just a child, the commonness of it all, the sort of the portrayal of all the different strata of society and the ordinariness of the characters, especially the characters in the framing device, is pretty unique for that time period. No? Yes?
Yeah. It's less unique than you would think. You do have what are known as like estates literature, which so the three estates of medieval society are the gentry, the church, and then like the working people. And you do have this genre of estates literature that is about sort of like depictions, often comedic depictions, of the lives of people in these different estates. But the Canterbury Tales does it to such a sort of depth and with such fully fleshed out characters that oftentimes people actually get a little defensive if you refer to it as just being estates literature, if you suggest that it's just an example of this genre. There is definitely, if not a uniqueness to it, a depth to it that I think is not quite there in any contemporary work.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I feel like one of the quiet running themes of this podcast is when authors are talented and empathetic enough to infuse their work with that level of depth. That is one of the things that makes works really timeless, even if it's way off base from your experience. When you have characters who feel really fleshed out, you can connect with them across the centuries.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it also helps that some of Chaucer's characters also continue to recur in later authors who we similarly think of as being kind of timeless. You know, The Knight's Tale, as I said, was retold by Shakespeare as The Two Noble Kinsmen. A lot of the tales in the Canterbury Tales were tales that already existed in Boccaccio, in Ovid. There are tales that get retold in other authors. One of Shakespeare's English contemporaries, John Gower, who I think, if circumstances had been just a little different, probably could have been remembered just as much as like a luminary of English as Chaucer was, but just Chaucer ended up being the more famous one. The two knew each other. They were friends. Chaucer left Gower in charge of his estate at one point when he was in Italy. Gower wrote a number of poems, one of which, Confessio Amantis, includes several stories that are also in the Canterbury Tales. You know, these are tales that already were popular because of their sort of like timelessness. So I think it was really easy for that to continue to be the case. And I think even like in the modern literary climate, where there's definitely a little more criticism around the Canterbury Tales. You know, that's still there, because the things that we have been critical about are also often things that are kind of timeless. And so even as we approach Chaucer through lenses that are like feminist or post-colonial or, you know, various more sort of like critical approaches to Chaucer, there's still a timelessness to it that allows us to do those things. Like, there are still these timeless questions about like the position of women and the just like really fuzzy question of consent in fragment one, which, spoiler, keeps coming up.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Marjorie, really, with the like...
Marjorie just wants to be a part of the podcast. And you know what? I think you should stop standing in her way. But on the subject of consent, I've been, somewhat coincidentally, I've been reading Dr. Eleanor Yanega's The Once and Future Sex. Are you familiar with that one?
I am not. I'm loving the name, though, as a, you know, fan of Arthuriana.
It just came out in the last, I think, year and a half. And it's specifically about... Marjorie's just having a... Is she having a vision right now? Is she in communication with her God? Is she ascending to a higher plane?
We've got one of those things that's like a ball and like a spinny track, and she is just spinning it around and around and around and around. And I threw a paper towel at her, and she was like, what the f-?
Oh, so I've been reading Dr. Eleanor Yanega's The Once and Future Sex, which is specifically about medieval women and their gender roles and their how their sexuality was perceived and all of that stuff. It's really good. It's very interesting. It's very well done. Very accessible for those of you out there who maybe don't, you know, love to read history, don't love to read really dry history. She's very funny and very good at writing. But one of the things that she talked about at length that popped into my head when we were talking about especially the second two tales in the middle two tales in the fragment was a thing that a lot of people don't realize if they aren't super well versed in the period is that the stereotype about women and sort of feminine horniness is completely inverted today from where it was in the medieval era, and that women were considered just like insatiably horny idiots who had to be governed by men partly to keep them from constantly just being horny all over the place. And one of the things that led to was kind of an idea that if you correctly sort of romanced a woman, she would eventually be on board even if she said she wasn't.
Like, yeah, you know, I think, you know, it is probably a surprise to nobody who knows me, but I always find it wild the degree to which people like sort of think that gender roles through history have been this very static thing when they really haven't. And oftentimes, yeah, a problem that arises when we look at like medieval literature through a feminist lens, but forget to look at it through a lens that takes into account the context, is that we do miss these things. And like, yeah, medieval women are depicted as profoundly horny. I've actually been reading Virgin Whore by Maggie Solberg, who's a wonderful medieval scholar who just agreed actually to serve as the fifth member of my dissertation committee.
Oh, yay, exciting.
And one of the things that she talks about is like the depiction of Mary as horny in like medieval mystery plays and stuff like that, and the way in which, one, it's this sort of inversion because it's like Mary's horny, but also Mary's perfect in all things and God made horniness anyway. So like Mary's just being horny because it's how God made her. But also the idea of the horny woman is high comedy in the Middle Ages. And it keeps showing up, of course, in the Canterbury Tales. I mean, you know, this is getting ahead a little, but in the Merchant's Tale, I want to say you have this classic story of old man married to a young woman that he just can't keep up with. And, you know, it's interesting. It always reminds me of the controversy around that, you know, the song, Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of when people are like, oh, you know, but she keeps telling him no, and he keeps being like, oh, let's do it, and you know, this is a really problematic song, and people missing the whole thing where she's so full of shit. I mean, she's saying, oh, you know, what will my aunt say? Oh, it must be the drink. While also just like constantly signaling that like, yeah, no, we're going to do this. We're going to fuck. I just want to make sure that I've exhausted every necessary social excuse.
It's called plausible deniability, Brad.
Exactly. When you get into these things like with the Miller's wife and the Miller's daughter, even when you take out Boccaccio's sort of much more enthusiastic Melanie, there's this idea. I mean, by the morning one, they've had sex three times, and she is like, I love you. Here's where my father hid your stolen bread. Come back and see me. But I mean, realistically, even the Miller's wife, the idea is that like, oh, well, this happened because she's drunk and horny. And like, honestly, even if she'd realized that it was, you know, John halfway through, she still would have gone for it. I mean,
I definitely couldn't remember which one was my bed.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason why the carpenter in the Miller's tale and the miller in the Reeves tale are so possessive of their, you know, women, so to speak, is because, like, yeah, if I'm not, obviously, they're going to fuck the, you know, young, sexy, wily students with their nice hair and their fancy Latin.
Right, because women are just faithless, ultra horny. Our humors are very wet and cold, and that leads us to be absolutely unstoppable horn dogs.
It's really funny. At one point in the Reeves tale, it's stated that the Miller's wife is the daughter of the local pastor, which is not supposed to happen. Medieval priests, you know, just like modern Catholic priests, are not supposed to marry or have sex. But it was also something that was very common. And like in this case, seems to be something that elevates her status in the town.
Oh.
And one of my favorite things that you constantly see show up in medieval literature too, is that it's like, of course the women of town are going to want to the priest. That's why you have to be so careful as a priest, because you've got to understand women are horny. And you're the best guy there is because you're a godly man. You have got to be on the lookout because there is nothing that women want to do more than bone down with a man of God.
Absolve me, Daddy.
And the thing is, like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, you get it, right? Like, I like every, you know, red-blooded woman in America, I watched Midnight Mass and was like, that priest is hot. Fleabag. I mean, like, we're all, it's relatable. Maybe they knew what they were talking about in the Middle Ages.
They knew what was up. And just to, like, circle back around very quickly, I think it's really important, especially with medieval literature, because the overweening stereotype that I think kicked off sort of mid-20th century, is the stereotype that, like, women hate sex. And women are never horny, and women have to be coerced into wanting sex and coaxed into caring about sex. It's very important to remember that these are dumb cultural stereotypes and dumb gender roles and are not consistent across history. And that's it.
You even, with like sort of the popularity of like humoral medicine towards the end of the Middle Ages and then like into the early modern period, you know, you have these ideas of people having like humors that are either hot or cold and either moist or dry. And of course, like women have a hot, moist humor, which, you know, you can just imagine all the innuendo that you can make out of that.
In your endo. No. Well, is there any other ground you really wanted to make sure that we covered today? Anything else you really want to touch on?
Oh my God, Marjorie, I am going to eat you. I'm going to stew you in a little white wine and tomato, and I'm going to eat you.
Sounds delicious. Just another day of eating pussy on the podcast. Well, that was a very fun adventure through.
Stop! She never plays this much with anything.
I told you, she's having a vision. She's gonna dictate them to a monk next. That was great. I enjoyed it very much, and I am looking forward to our sort of extended occasional series on the Canterbury Tales. So thanks so much for so much rattling.
She's just, yeah, I mean, I think Marjorie's in the podcast now.
Yep, it's fine. Well, is there anything... is there anything you would like to plug? Is there anywhere you'd like to be found?
If anyone is interested in seeing my occasionally academic and generally very bad tweets, you can find me on Twitter at MotherFoolian. Also, again, at UNC Chapel Hill, you can find me on there. I feel like I lost all coherence there. Sorry.
That's all right. I think we both have, but you know, we're on a long pilgrimage here, and we're weary. Well, thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back together soonish to talk about more of the Canterbury Tales.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank all of you for joining us. And as always, if you can, this week, this month, this pay period, consider supporting a living author, because they could really use the help. Bye. Oh my God, I'm about to piss myself. Bye.
Goodbye.